This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Scholar Anne Maria Makudu roots her cultural anthropology research in the space she knows best, her own history. She was born to an English mother and a South African father and lived in three different countries by the age of 16. Her mother's background in social work and her father's work as an archbishop and anti-apartheid activist brought culture and conflict to their dinner table conversations. Anne Maria now focuses her research on areas like South Africa, globalization, and cities as an associate professor at Duke University. Anne Maria, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much.
You are joining us now from England in a small flat where you are quarantining. Tell us a bit about what you're doing in the UK.
Right. So I was born in England, and after my parents retired, they returned to London. And so my husband and I are currently ensconced in this little flat in southwest London, waiting the 14 days of quarantine so we can go and join my father, who is, well, about six stops down the train line on the district line. And so we're going to form what in British legislative language is referred to as a support bubble, which I think in the US people refer to as a pod. And we'll do that in about 10, 11 days.
So there to visit your father, and there's so much throughout your whole life story that kind of traces back to this, to your roots, growing up in England and living and growing up with a family that is very cosmopolitan. And I'd love to kind of talk a bit about that link now and get into some of that personal history, maybe starting with your parents, who have quite an interesting story about how they met. Tell us a bit about that story.
Sure. So my father, I think I could say, was probably developing an activist voice from the pulpit in the late 1950s and very, very early 1960s in South Africa, and eventually was compelled, I think, by friends but also by family to leave South Africa. 1960 marked the banning of many of the anti-apartheid political organizations, including the African National Congress and Pan-Africanist Congress. Many folk left the country. Those organizations went underground. Some people would refer to that decade that followed of the 60s as a silent decade, which was marked by censorship and increasing repression in the country. And so he ultimately got on a train and crossed the border from South Africa into what was then known as the Bechuanaland Protectorate, later to become Botswana, that year. And eventually went up to a small town called Francistown in the north of the country, and began to minister there in a small parish. He's an Anglican. It took him until 1963 to obtain a passport. Having left South Africa, he ostensibly revoked on his right to citizenship in the Republic of South Africa, which really was an absurd claim, but it was the claim made by the government at the time, because black South Africans really didn't enjoy citizenship rights, and he wouldn't have had a passport or travel document anyway. So for 3 years, he was essentially a refugee. And in 63, again, managed to obtain a passport, traveled to the United Kingdom, went off to Birmingham to complete seminary. And after that was done with, he went back up to London and joined a parish with a fair number of junior clergy. So that was really his first parish as a fully inducted priest. And it just so happened that my mother also had a job in that parish running a youth club. She had trained in social work. She'd also been certified in theology. And that is essentially how they met in 65. And this was in the East End of London.
The way you talk about the story of how they met and everything about your family history is so rich in detail. And you speak about it as if, you know, you are an archivist kind of uncovering this history. Have you spent a lot of time interviewing both of your parents and collecting these early stories? Or what draws you to, or what allows you to have this level of detail to share their stories and experience? Mm.
Well, of course, memory and then the things that report people report to you may not be entirely accurate, but I think this is basically the gist of it. I'm clearly interested in history. My work as an anthropologist is in the historical mode. Certainly some of my earlier work relied on archives. And I also have a colleague who, in fact, is writing a biography of my father's. And so over the last few years, we've had a good deal of conversation about trying to recuperate that history. But I also think perhaps those kinds of biographical details are most especially important when they come from a place that's so unusual, and where without the relaying of those memories, that history, there's not a great deal of documentation to rely upon, because immediate family members who might be able to tell those stories are not present, right? If you're growing up in exile or you're a refugee and so on. So I think perhaps that's part of the reason. And just to try and come to an understanding of how two people who in some respects grew up in such different environments came together, and then in certain respects were at one and the same time so similar, so well matched.
So your parents met in the mid-60s, and then you were born in the UK, as you mentioned at the very beginning of this. So as a young person growing up there with parents who are intellectuals, who are rigorous thinkers, your father who has this rich personal history already, what was your experience like at that point as a young child in England? What do you remember from that time?
Again, of course, memory can be quite distortive, but I think I remember actually British racism, truthfully. The 1970s, really 70s, late 60s, early 70s. Britain, I think, was probably still, in fact, may still be recovering from its history of empire. And in a sense, there was perhaps a post-imperial nostalgia. In a way, Britain had been hammered by two world wars. I think in the 60s, Britain was still recovering from World War II. The economy was on somewhat shaky ground, and then moving into the 1970s. And I also think that the experience of being Black British is very different from the experience of being, say, African American, because the depth of history of Black British immigration into Britain is much shorter. And I think that's coming out quite a lot in popular cultural accounts now. So that there was a very limited repertoire of language for speaking about the experience of being a Briton of color. In a way that on the other side of a civil rights movement, whatever that civil rights movement may or may not have achieved, there was certainly a fairly agreed upon language or discourse about race.
Do you remember,
as contentious as that language or discourse is?
Yeah, do you remember early conversations with your father as a young kid talking about Blackness and race?
Not so much about our experience. I mean, I think that my late brother and I were in some ways sort of self-disciplined as children can be about the things that we felt that we should or shouldn't bother our parents with. But there were a number of encounters at school and in public life that I think made us both very, very aware of the fact that, one, we were ostensibly different, and two, that was not a good thing. And we may not have had the language to really address that with our parents. At the same time, we were pretty aware that my father, for example, was working with a group of people on a thing called the Program to Combat Racism. We were fairly aware of his history as a Black South African, and also aware that there were other émigrés in London and its environs with whom we socialized, with whom we grew up, and so on. So, for example, in the early 70s, we spent not a huge amount of time, but a fair amount of time with the Tutu family. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his wife Leah and their children, as part of a broader community of South Africans in exile, Southern Africans in exile, and more broadly, people from the Caribbean, West Indians, you know, that sort of thing. So in that sense, I think we were conscious. But again, there wasn't a language to speak about racism in the way that people in Britain might today, or in the way that I think in the US there's a repertoire of things that you can say.
All right, we're going to take a pause in this conversation and come back after a quick break. I'm speaking with Anne Maria Makudu, an associate professor of cultural anthropology and African and African American studies at Duke University. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Anne Maria Makudu has long been a global citizen. Her family followed the trail of her father's work as a priest and a leader in the church, all the way from England to Switzerland to Botswana. Her globally diverse upbringing and her parents' work introduce her to global issues and conflicts that are the ones that she still researches today. Anne Maria is currently an associate professor of cultural anthropology in African and African American studies at Duke University. So you mentioned before the break being a kid kind of very aware of what your parents were doing as people in the community, as activists, as thinkers. Being so aware of that as a young kid, what did that mean for you in terms of where you turned to kind of process your everyday life? Did it mean that you kind of grew up really fast because you were in this really intellectual environment, or did you turn to friends or your brother?
That's a good question. I think we just quietly processed. I mean, maybe it was to do with certain sorts of cultural expectations around the things that you might speak about or not. And again, I have a sense that we perhaps self-policed, my brother and I, in terms of what we felt was okay to say or not say. And because we were in the middle of a conversation that was operating at a much higher level than we could probably engage. So our day-to-day experiences, say at school or nursery school, or in sometimes uncomfortable social encounters, were not things that we really, you know, came out and said, okay, this thing has happened and we feel uncomfortable about it. And perhaps it was also about the nature of, well, effectively a British upbringing,
not a
stereotype. Not a stereotype, but that you sort of keep things to yourself and you're not too emotional about everything. But there were things that clearly were not quite right. And again, I think it goes back to what was happening in Britain at the time, which was a sort of 15 to 20 year, now 2 decades long, timeline in which Black Britishness was emerging.
So tell us about your family's transition from England to Switzerland, then to Botswana, and what it was like to go through those multiple migrations, all before you were 16 years old.
Yeah. So in 75, we moved from London to Geneva, and my father decided for a whole variety of reasons to step back from the parish priest life. He got a desk job. He went and worked for the World Council of Churches, and he was assigned to something called the Africa Desk. And his responsibility was primarily working with refugees all across the African continent, but primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, with the exclusion, with the exception of South Africa, where the World Council of Churches was regarded as a banned organization. They were not permitted to operate. And so for 4 years, we lived in Geneva. And my brother and I got sent to the local French medium school, first primary school and then I suppose the equivalent of middle school would be, yeah, the equivalent in the US, with the idea that, well, we might as well just do full immersion language learning, and we would take an out of class from time to time to do sort of remedial French instruction, but by and large it was just full immersion. And I remember in the evenings sitting with my mother, who had studied French in grammar school in London, but not to a particularly advanced level, sitting there with a dictionary and looking up absolutely every single word.
How frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. So that was sort of the way I think my parents thought about cultural immersion. And it may also have been to do with the fact that my father is polylingual. He speaks close to 15, 16 languages, all 11 of the official languages of South Africa, and then some.
Wow.
So probably from his perspective, you know, this shouldn't be too difficult. And of course, we were of an age where actually, relatively speaking, it wasn't. So that was a pretty dramatic experience.
Did you feel a lot of pressure? I mean, knowing that, you know, your parents are coming from this context and now you're in a situation where you're being expected to thrive in a different language, that seems like it would put a lot of pressure on you as a preteen.
Yeah. I honestly, again, don't think that we thought about it that way. And perhaps British upbringing, I don't know, which isn't to say that my parents weren't accommodating. They absolutely were. And the fact that my mother sat there every night with us with a dictionary, you know, absolutely says something about her. But I think the way that it was seen was as, number one, an opportunity. And number two is something that was sort of a non-negotiable. So we, of course, saw new things. We saw different things. We traveled a little bit. We had this routine where we used to cross the border. There was a border post very close to where we lived that gained you access to France. And so we would go on the weekend and we would go shopping in France, and then we'd go for a picnic in the mountains and then come home, you know, this sort of thing. And we traveled a little bit through mostly France, but a little bit in the Alps on the Italian, northern Italian border. And we went on a few trips with my parents when in fact my father was working. And then we would cross the channel in the summers to go back and visit my grandmother who was in London. So yeah, a lot of pressure, but again, I think it was regarded as an opportunity for some sort of, you know, expansion of the horizons, that sort of thing. And perhaps also for my father, that he had been on the move for so long that he may not have thought about these kinds of upheavals and displacements in quite the same way.
Was your family pretty religious? I mean, I know your father had stepped away and worked at a desk job, but then he again went back to become an archbishop. So how did that affect your home life in terms of religion? Was that an important component of the family?
It was, and became increasingly complicated for me. So my late brother was a person of very, very profound faith, as was my mother and as is my father. And I just popped out completely differently. Was a secularist from the start, and this became most uncomfortable in and around the time I went up for confirmation at age 16, which was already regarded as relatively late, and read catechism and, you know, went through all the catechism training, and then noted that, well, part of the catechism was the acknowledgement of having arrived at one's years of discretion. And so I sort of turned this argument back on my parents and said, well, I think I've reached my years of discretion, and I think I've decided I don't want to get confirmed. And that really wasn't an option in the circumstances. And we later came to a much better understanding on both sides of what having faith and not having faith meant. And I think as the years went by and it became clear that I was a thinker, but I was a thinker in a very different way, that it became acceptable for us to agree to disagree. But yes, it was a very prominent aspect of life, from things like, you know, saying grace at dinner, from going to church on Sundays, from my father's sort of now, I mean, absolutely more than ever, perhaps, routine of daily prayer, early in the morning, before going to bed, in the late afternoon, you know. So, yeah, no, it was a very, very significant aspect of family life.
Tell me about how you got introduced to dance, because it seems like you turned, that was a place where it was maybe less of an intellectual pursuit for you, more of a creative and embodied pursuit.
Yeah. I started ballet lessons when we were still in London at age 4. And when we moved to Switzerland, continued to take classes more intensely because I was a little bit older. Interestingly, also with an English instructor. And when we were leaving Switzerland in 79, she sat my mother down and said, you know, I think this would be the moment, if Anne-Marie is very serious about dancing, this would be the moment to see if she can't go back to England while you go to Botswana, see if she can't go to ballet boarding school, maybe even audition for something like the Royal Ballet School. And my mother wasn't really interested in that. I'm not entirely clear of the reasons. I wonder if it didn't have something to do with her own experiences as a child during the war years. Her school was evacuated to the country, and so she left London and for several years was away from her mother. And I think that was a very formative experience for her, both positively and not so positively. So the idea that I would be away and I would be in boarding school, even though a lot of English people do that with their children, she wasn't comfortable with that. And so really we had to come to an agreement that when I was 16, if I was still interested, then I could go back to boarding school in England, I could go to performing arts school. But in the years that I was in Botswana, there really weren't the same kinds of opportunities for training. There was a ballet teacher who would drive across the border from what was then Bophuthatswana, one of the ethnic homelands, into Botswana every weekend. He would come on a Friday night, and he would teach Friday night through Sunday morning. And so we had to condense, you know, all of that dance training into a few days every week.
So were you practicing on your own in the interim time?
I had very close schoolmates who also had aspirations to going to ballet boarding school. And interestingly, so these were two sisters, and one of them ended up at the same performing arts school with me later on back in England, so post 16. I suppose you could say we practiced together. And at the time, there wasn't an awful lot going on for tweens and young teenagers in Gaborone, the capital in Botswana. And so we were quite creative about putting on plays and musicals and dancing and doing all sorts of things that presumably helped, but, you know, were not sufficient to a commitment to a professional career, really. Yeah.
So while your family was living in Botswana, your father was a clergyman, and he had obviously professional jobs and work he was doing during the day, but also was establishing an underground railroad to get anti-apartheid activists out of South Africa. And your home became kind of an important, essential location that was part of this process. So take me into that. It's seems like a really fascinating thing to witness as a young kid.
Yeah. So again, memory serves in the way that it serves. You know, it's not entirely clear. But what I do know in hindsight is that both my brother and, interestingly, my mother, I didn't realize this till much, much later, and I were really shielded from what was going on. I think early on, when I came to a recognition of, oh, something must be happening here, I was convinced that my mother was in on whatever the secret was. And it later emerged that no, she wasn't, and quite rightly too, because this was a way of protecting all of us. If we had knowledge, then we could be targets of something. So, yeah, I think that in the first year or two that we were living in Botswana, so 79, 80, this was probably a period of time when my father was trying to lay the groundwork for whatever would happen next. He did concede in hindsight that those early years were quite terrifying for him, that he used to go out and check under the undercarriage of the car to ensure that there wasn't a bomb underneath it. It became clear over time that the house was bugged and the phone was tapped. The phone was pretty blatant in those days. So this was, you know, early to mid 1980s. Botswana didn't have the telecommunications capacity to support international phone calls. And so all international phone calls had to be booked through a central exchange in South Africa, which meant, of course, that you couldn't really have a confidential conversation about much of anything, right? So I think that we became fairly conscious of that. There was always this strange way that you picked up the phone, you asked for the central exchange, you booked a phone call, and when you went to pick up the phone call at the appointed hour, there were all sorts of strange clicks on the line, and sometimes you could hear voices in the background, you know, this sort of thing. So the situation in South Africa was becoming more and more serious politically, more and more unstable. Certainly by the mid-1980s, 85, 86, you had the declaration of a state of emergency. And in the meantime, there are people who are crossing the border illicitly into Botswana at Klokwang and along the border in places where there wasn't a fence, there wasn't policing of that border. And some of them would knock on the door in the middle of the night, and my father would go and have a conversation, and we came to understand, not fully comprehending the content of the conversation, that there was a vetting going on. Could he sort out whether this person was genuinely who they claimed they were? And sometimes he just sort of had a, I suppose you might call it an intuition, you know, a gut sense that things were not as they should be. He would mention things like, so-and-so is dropping a lot of names, which makes me feel nervous, makes me feel that perhaps they're trying to trace my network of contacts. And so again, as much as we didn't really know the content of what was going on, there was a little humor around this, which was, if there was a lack of certainty about somebody's bona fides, the joke was, well, we'll call the Mennonite guest house and we can have you put up there for the night, which,
so
which
code,
is always a signal.
Code
for this is not, you know, this is not kosher. So, but as it emerged, a number of people passed through the house, and some of them were quite obviously important people in the anti-apartheid struggles, affiliated with many of the organizations. I think the most prominent of whom was probably Oliver Tambo, who was the head of the African National Congress in exile in the headquarters in Lusaka in Zambia. He passed through. Uncle Oliver, so supposedly, you know. There were people who passed through the house who were government officials, which is to say of the Botswana government. Again, later on, I think I sorted out that that had to do with support from things like Interpol and so on. And then we had a fellow priest come and stay with us for about 6 months.
I'm going to pause you right there because we have to take a quick break, yeah. And I'll have you tell the rest of that story when we return in just a moment as our conversation continues with Anne Maria Mukudu, an associate professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. My guest today is scholar Anne Maria Mukudu. Through her research in cultural anthropology and in African and African American studies at Duke University, she seeks to parse through her personal experiences with place and race. So you were telling the story of your experience witnessing your father build and run this underground railroad in Botswana, and you were about to set up a story about a priest who stayed with you all.
Right. So John Osmus was originally from New Zealand, but had come and worked in the Southern African region. I believe he was based in Lesotho, which is in itself a very odd place, given that it's landlocked within South Africa, within the borders of South Africa. And during the years of the anti-apartheid struggles, I think that border was quite porous for the South African authorities. He had been doing some work for the African National Congress, and the security, police, intelligence, I think, caught wind of what he was doing, and he ended up on a blacklist, which I suppose must have been a kill list because he was sent a parcel bomb, and the sum total result of which was he lost a hand and he blew out one of his eardrums. He ended up living with us for 6 months. And by this time, my brother and I think, were old enough to not only begin to put two and two together, but also to have the courage to ask questions. And I know at one point we did ask, well, if John Osmus is, you know, on a list like this and he's at such risk, how on earth is he safely staying with us? And how does that make us safe or unsafe? So that was probably the most dramatic example of all of this. But again, as time went by, I think we became more and more conscious of what was going on. And then in the early 2000s, the Norwegian church really sort of, well, kind of blew the lid off all of this. I mean, this was after the transition to democracy in 94, and some of my father's, if you will, co-conspirators or collaborators who had worked both within the Norwegian church and for the Norwegian Foreign Ministry, which is where a whole bunch of money was being really originated in the Foreign Ministry and was being directed towards the effort to help young people who are trying to leave South Africa and to support them in things like gaining additional education and training. They really sort of exposed the story, and so it became clear, okay, now we can connect all the dots, and this is what's really been going on.
Well,
all of this time.
You had such rich experiences, and there's so much to explore in your early story, but I want to take you a bit through some paces and get to today so we have time to talk about your work at Duke. So you came to the U.S. originally to study dance at the Alvin Ailey Dance Company, and then from there decided that wasn't going to be your professional pursuit and decided to turn to anthropology. So tell us about that transition and how you decided you wanted to go into academia after originally thinking dance was going to be your career.
Yeah, I'm not the only one. There's a kind of unlikely number, small, but nevertheless significant number, unlikely number of actually former black women dancers who have turned to anthropology specifically. Some of the earliest ones being people, I wouldn't put myself in this category with these people, but in any case, Zora Neale Hurston, Pearl Primus, Catherine Dunham. So maybe there's a thread there. I'm not quite sure what it is, but yeah, and I determined that I was good, but I wasn't great, and that's never enough in the world of professional dance. And so I think, to the great relief of everybody, most especially my parents, I decided to go to college 5 years late. So I was considered a mature student. And I think I wanted to do something a little bit along the lines of what my mother had studied. She had gone and studied politics, philosophy and economics, PPE, at the London School of Economics. And so I started in the social sciences, and I really sampled them like a buffet. And the only one that made me feel comfortable, or rather comfortable with the logic at the center of that particular discipline, was anthropology. And I'm sure it had to do with the way that anthropology, at least on the face of it, is accepting of difference, is supposed to be a value neutral discipline. Well, maybe, but in principle, is a discipline that doesn't make judgment, doesn't have a sort of a value baseline, and has a history of working in and inquiring in places beyond Euro-America, beyond the Anglo-American tradition. And so that made the greatest of sense to me. I think that's really why I chose it.
How did you decide to make South Africa the focus of your academic work? I mean, obviously you had the personal connection with your father and uncovering a lot of that history. But I imagine there's kind of a dual mechanism going on in you, which is, you know, curiosity, but also how much do you want to bridge the personal and the academic, or how much should those worlds overlap for you? How did you make that decision?
Right. I think all academic projects are ultimately biographical. The through line sometimes is clear and sometimes not. In my case, probably clearer than most. And I certainly thought that being able to do work in South Africa would be an opportunity to begin to make connections that I had not had the opportunity to enjoy, because I wouldn't have been able to enter South Africa really before the transition. I did once or twice, but by and large, it was something that we didn't do in the late 80s and early 90s. So it presented an opportunity. Just as I was completing my undergraduate work at Columbia, my last semester was the semester, the spring semester of 1994, was the semester that South Africa held its first multi-party democratic elections in April of that year. So I think that probably had some bearing. I entered graduate school in the fall of 94, and my the two people who became my central advisors are also South African, and because of the limitations on doing research in South Africa, and because they too had to leave South Africa about a decade after my father did, they had turned to history, and they had turned to the archive, and they had done work on the history of missionization in South Africa by working in the archive for the London Missionary Society. So you could do work, but you could do it remotely, as it were. They basically trained the first generation of anthropologists at the University of Chicago who, by and large, interestingly, were South African, and notably also wanted to do work in South Africa. This was the first time in the mid to late 1990s when people could either go for the first time, as in my case, or return. So I think that alignment, you know, of my own interests and then the fact of these advisors, Jean and John Komaroff, made it possible for me to do something that for prior generations of anthropologists had been really unthinkable. And they also influenced the way that I think about history, because they had done so much work in the archive and had really helped to develop this subdiscipline of historical anthropology.
I'm curious about, I read a piece that you wrote for the Huffington Post about buying your engagement ring and getting your engagement ring. and it brought up for me this conundrum that I'm sure many academics and deep thinkers experience, which is that, you know, you're so embedded in history and thinking critically about race and capitalism and how everything is connected, yet you are, and you are a human who is living in the world and having a personal life and is getting engaged and mm-hmm. wants to get an engagement mm-hmm. ring. And you went through this kind of conundrum with your partner of trying to find an engagement ring that, you know, you found beautiful and you wanted to wear, but also didn't implicate you in the problematic history that you'd spent so much time uncovering and thinking deeply about. So maybe you can tell us that story and reflect on how you mm-hmm. bridge that deep critical academic work and being a human in the world. A big question, I know.
Well, I think that's quite a biographical question because, you know, for example, being born into a family where someone is clergy is a little bit that sort of tension between the principles and belief and faith of that person, in my case, my father, but actually my mother and in fact brother as well, and the idea that that faith then translates into a series of principles for living. And yet, is it really the case that, and I think for a time people believe this, is it really the case that clergy and their families should live in poverty, for example, should take a vow of poverty, you know? Mm-hmm. Or because you are a critic of modern day capitalism, so you were trained in Marxism as I was at the University of Chicago, are you really supposed to take a vow of poverty and live in poverty? You know, this is what I often say to graduate students, that you have very fine ideas and you think about the world in wonderfully critical ways, but you're not supposed to live in a dungeon.
Right.
You're not supposed to not enjoy life. And the reality is that our system, which is to say our economic and political and social and cultural system or systems globally, implicate all of us in ways that make it very difficult for us to entirely extricate ourselves from things like supply chains. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you live a commendable life and yet you're a consumer? It's impossible. So, and I think with time and age and maturity, one comes to realize that this is a tension that is really irreconcilable. But it is true that when my now husband Michael and I got engaged, we wanted to mark that by my having an engagement ring, and then we went through the rigmarole of how to do this, and is it really true that the supply chains for diamonds that are not blood diamonds are really recognizable? And I went around and I asked people, how do you know the provenance of this diamond? Well, we don't really know, you know, this
right, no one knows.
Sort of thing. No one knows. And so eventually we decided that, well, recycling makes the world go round and we could do that instead. The irony is that we ultimately landed, as that article, that op-ed that you mentioned suggests, we landed on a vintage ring. But because of its style and because of the tint of the gemstone, it brought me all the way back to South Africa. So you could date it to about 1910 or thereabouts. That was the style. And it turns out that the fact that the diamond in the center had a particular hue, which was slightly yellow, meant that it had some sort of mineral deposit inside it that made it look that way, that was typical of diamonds that were mined in Kimberley in South Africa. So there we were, re-implicated in a supply chain that, of course, stretches, you know, what is it, 150-odd years or so, a little bit more than that. 180 years. So, I think that is, in a way, the challenge of thinking deeply. It's also very rewarding. But thinking deeply or believing deeply, having profound faith, are things that put you both in the world and then enable you to step back from it to see certain things that are contradictions or illogics or problems. But then you have to live in the world.
I only have about a minute left for this last question, but I'd love to know what projects you're working on now and what's next for you.
Yeah. So I'm trying to finish a book manuscript, which for now is entitled South Africa After the Rainbow. The rainbow essentially is a shorthand for multicultural, multi-ethnic, wonderfully multiracial South Africa, which was really a dream, which didn't come true. And I'm focusing on the frustrations and struggles and overcoming of the young generation of people who were born free after 94, who are now hitting up against the sort of structural obstacles of present-day South Africa, whether in the education space or in the professional space, attempting to get on, up, and out. And so that's what I'm worrying about at the moment, and thinking about how they become members of a middle class, which is what many of them aspire to.
Anne Maria Makudu is an associate professor of cultural anthropology and African and African American studies at Duke University. Thank you so much for being here, and have a wonderful time with your father.
Thank you so much.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.